Hello, my brothers and sisters, and other pagan listeners. This is Christian Anarchy, and my name is Jeremiah. And I've got 99 problems, and I blame the government for 98 of them.
We begin with concluding remarks. Break up the pieces and examine the parts. Your words always cut when they're cliche. But here's my knife because I came for the buffet. This is the way it goes when you're a part of it. Nervously saying words, little surprising bed. A mark beneath the
Merry Christmas-ish. Could be Christmas when you're listening, I guess, but I hope on that day specifically you're busy spending time with friends and family. We'll get the housekeeping stuff out of the way up front. If you would like to contact me, my email address is jeremiahjm@gmail.com. And if you would like to listen to other episodes of the podcast, look at different resources, check sources, or do something ridiculous like waste your money by donating it to me, you can go to www.christianarchy.net. All right, that's adequate. If you've read the title for today, this episode is obviously about the secular humanist and pagan culture war on Christmas in the United States. Someone has got to take a stand against the war on Christmas. And there will be no happy holidays around here, no Hanukkah, no happy winter solstice, and I don't accept products and services from cashiers or baristas or even auto mechanics if they don't say Merry Christmas. Actually, I don't really care. That's not at all what this episode's about. What I want to talk about today is the war on Christmas Day. It was a day during World War I where something very spectacular happened on the 25th of December. As we all know, war sucks. It's usually a bunch of ruler followers duped by patriotism, nationalism, and no matter how aggressive their war is, everyone involved often assumes it's some sort of defensive act, as if they're fighting to protect families and friends, even if their actions are only hurting other families and their families are in no real danger. War kills so many people and destroys so much economic activity and wealth, which I care about, not so that greedy people can satisfy their every whim and desire, but because the more wealth is in the world, the more likely it is for the basic needs and even beyond basic needs of every human to be met. Well, you're welcome for that piece of information. I guess that's why you listen to me, for that hard-hitting and controversial view that war is destructive. Glad I could teach you something new. Anyway, war sucks, but something very special happened on December 25th, 1914, in the middle of World War I, between the trenches. Something different, nearly spontaneous, where there wasn't a mindless drone-like following of rulers, and people were, at least for a day, not blinded by patriotism or by the demonization of their enemy. On this day, soldiers from both sides recognized their enemy was their brother. There was something about this Christmas spirit, this Jesus come to earth, that was especially powerful that day. Powerful enough for each side to abandon their idols of nationalism and see, instead of their respective flags, the image of God in the people they were trying to kill the day previous. It's called the Christmas Truce of World War I, where troops on both sides of the front lines, kind of all across the front lines in various places, had an impromptu truce where they got together, they met in the middle and between the trenches in no man's land, and some of them sang together, kicked a ball around, exchanged food and goods, and ate together. They took some time to bury bodies of their fellow fallen soldiers and held little funeral services for them without trying to kill each other. It was an extraordinary event. To talk about this event, what I'm going to do is read a fictional letter written by a guy named Andrew Shepherd. And almost everything in this letter is based on actual letters from troops about the Christmas Truce of 1914. And I think there's a book that is a collection of these letters, and you can find a ton of them online if you're interested in reading more. And the reason I want to read this letter is, one, it's easier and it's Christmas, so that means I should be a little lazier, correct? And why reinvent the wheel? When I reinvent the wheel, it's less circular and more octagonal, and I'd rather just go ahead and read someone else's wheel. He really paints the picture of what happened quite well and in a way I really appreciate, and I'm not a great storyteller. I can take some of the most interesting events and stories that have happened in my life and things that I've done and tell them in a way that is incredibly dull. I'm really better as an interpreter and explainer of stories' meanings than I am a storyteller, although some people have told me otherwise, but I think they're deceived by Satan. That's a little strong, but I don't trust them. My strong suit is not elegant language. I'm concise, clear, and straightforward. And if you wanted, if you guys begged me to, I could do more flowery language, like tulip, dandelion, daisy, cauliflower. But I don't really know how to do flowery language and have it make sense, and I just don't think people are going to want to listen to me if I'm not making sense. I have a hard enough time with that as it is. Anyway, let me get to this letter by Andrew Shepherd. This is how you can tell I'm in a weird mood when I start rambling on about nothing. Okay, thank you for indulging me. Without further ado, here's the letter from Andrew Shepherd, and I will link to this on the episode page number 28 on the website christianarchy.net. He says, "My dear Sister Janet, it is 2 a.m, and most of our men are asleep in their dugouts. Yet I could not sleep myself before writing to you of the wonderful events of Christmas Eve. In truth, what happened seems almost like a fairy tale, and if I hadn't been through it myself, I would scarce believe it. Just imagine, while you and the family sang carols before the fire there in London, I did the same with enemy soldiers here on the battlefields of France. As I wrote before, there has been little serious fighting of late. The first battles of the war left so many dead that both sides have held back until replacements could come from home. So we have mostly stayed in our trenches and waited. But what a terrible waiting it has been, knowing that any moment an artillery shell might land and explode beside us in the trench, killing or maiming several men, and in daylight not daring to lift our heads above ground for fear of a sniper's bullet. In the rain, it has fallen almost daily. Of course, it collects right in our trenches, where we must bail it out with pots and pans. And with the rain has come mud, a good foot or more deep. It splatters and cakes everything and constantly sucks at our boots. One new recruit got his feet stuck in it, and then his hands too when he tried to get up. Just like in that American story of the tar baby. Through all this, we couldn't help feeling curious about the German soldiers across the way. After all, they faced the same dangers we did, and slogged about in the same muck. What's more, their first trench was only 50 yards from ours. Between us lay no man's land, bordered on both sides by barbed wire, yet they were close enough we sometimes heard their voices. Of course we hated them when they killed our friends. But other times we joked about them and almost felt we had something in common. And now it seems they felt the same. Just yesterday morning, Christmas Eve day, we had our first good freeze. Cold as we were, we welcomed it because at least the mud froze solid. Everything was tinged white with frost, while a bright sun shone over all. Perfect Christmas weather. During the day, there was little shelling or rifle fire from either side, and as darkness fell on Christmas Eve, the shooting stopped entirely. Our first complete silence in months. We had hoped it might promise a peaceful holiday, but we didn't count on it. We'd been told the Germans might attack and try to catch us off guard. I went to the dugout to rest, and lying on my cot, I must have drifted asleep. All at once, my friend John was shaking me awake, saying, "Come and see. See what the Germans are doing. I grabbed my rifle, stumbled out into the trench, and stuck my head cautiously above the sandbags. I never hoped to see a stranger and more lovely sight. Clusters of tiny lights were shining all along the German line, left and right as far as the eye could see. "What is it?" I asked in bewilderment. And John answered, "Christmas trees." And so it was. The Germans had placed Christmas trees in front of their trenches, lit by candle or lantern like beacons of goodwill. We heard their voices raised in song. "Still Nacht, Heilig Nacht." This carol may not yet be familiar to us in Britain, but John knew it and translated, "Silent Night, Holy Night." I've never heard one lovelier or more meaningful in that quiet, clear night. It's dark, softened by a first quarter moon. When the song finished, the men in our trenches applauded. Yes, British soldiers applauding Germans. Then one of our own men started singing, and we all joined in. The first Noel, the angel did say, "In truth, we sounded not nearly as good as the Germans, with their fine harmonies." But they responded with enthusiastic applause of their own, and then began another, "O Tannenbaum, O Tannenbaum." Then we replied, "O come all ye faithful." But this time they joined in, singing the words in Latin, "Adeste Fidelis." British and German harmonizing across no man's land. I would have thought nothing could be more amazing, but what came next was more so. "English, come over," we heard one of them shout. "You no shoot, we no shoot." There, in the trenches, we looked at each other in bewilderment. Then one of us shouted jokingly, "You come over here." To our astonishment, we saw two figures rise from the trench, climb over their barbed wire, and advance unprotected across no man's land. One of them called, "Send officer to talk." I saw one of our men lift his rifle to the ready, and no doubt others did the same, but our captain called out, "Hold your fire." Then he climbed out and went to meet the Germans halfway. We heard him talking, and a few minutes later, the captain came back with a German cigar in his mouth. "We've agreed there will be no shooting before midnight tomorrow," he announced. "But sentries are to remain on duty, and the rest of you, stay alert." Across the way, we could make out groups of two or three men, starting out of trenches and coming toward us. Then some of us were climbing out too, and in minutes more, there we were in no man's land, over 100 soldiers and officers of each side, shaking hands with men we'd been trying to kill just hours earlier. Before long, a bonfire was built, and around it we mingled, British khaki and German gray. I must say, the Germans were the better dressed, with fresh uniforms for the holiday. Only a couple of our men knew German, but more of the Germans knew English. I asked one of them why that was. "Because many have worked in England," he said. "Before all this, I was a waiter at Hotel Cecil. Perhaps I waited on your table." "Perhaps you did," I said, laughing. He told me he had a girlfriend in London and that the war had interrupted their plans for marriage. I said, "Don't worry, we'll have you beat by Easter. Then you can come back and marry the girl." He laughed at that. Then he asked if I'd send her a postcard he'd give me later, and I promised I would. Another German had been a porter at Victoria Station. He showed me a picture of his family back in Munich. His eldest sister was so lovely, I told him I should like to meet her someday. He beamed and said he would like that very much, and gave me his family's address. Even those who could not converse could still exchange gifts: our cigarettes for their cigars, our tea for their coffee, our corned beef for their sausage. Badges and buttons from uniforms changed owners, and one of our lads walked off with the infamous spiked helmet. I myself traded a jackknife for a leather equipment belt, a fine souvenir to show when I got home. Newspapers, too, changed hands, and the Germans howled with laughter at ours. They assured us that France was finished and Russia nearly beaten, too. We told them that was nonsense, and one of them said, "Well, you believe your newspapers, and we'll believe ours." Clearly they are lied to, yet after meeting these men, I wonder how truthful our own newspapers have been. They are not the savage barbarians we've read so much about. They are men with homes and families, hopes and fears, principles and, yes, love of country. In other words, men like ourselves. Why are we led to believe otherwise? As it grew late, a few more songs were traded around the fire, and then all joined in for, I am not lying to you, Auld Lang Syne. Then we parted with promises to meet again tomorrow, and even some talk of a football match. I was just starting back to the trenches when an older German clutched my arm. My God, he said, why cannot we have peace and all go home? I told him gently, that you must ask your emperor. He looked at me then, searchingly. Perhaps, my friend, but also we must ask our hearts. And so, dear sister, tell me, has there ever been such a Christmas Eve in all history? And what does it all mean, this impossible befriending of enemies? For the fighting here, of course, it means regrettably little. Decent fellows those soldiers may be, but they follow orders, and we do the same. Besides, we are here to stop their army and send it home, and never could we shirk that duty. Still, one cannot help imagine what would happen if the spirit shown here were caught by the nations of the world. Of course, disputes must arise. But what if our leaders were to offer well wishes in place of warnings? Songs in place of slurs? Presence in place of reprisals? Would not all war end at once? All nations say they want peace. Yet on this Christmas morning, I wonder if we want it quite enough. Your loving brother, Tom. Lovely story and a lovely letter, right? I could end the podcast there, but I won't, because that was nowhere near enough of my own words for me to be satisfied. I don't know if you've heard about the Christmas truce before. I hope that you have, but I hope that this is a little bit of a new perspective or a larger perspective or a healthy reminder for you. It's such a heartwarming story in the middle of a war filled with sad stories and death and destruction. So I'd like to comment on the story, but I don't want to comment too much on the fictional letter Aaron wrote, as it is fictional. But again, almost all of the most substantive details are true, and I liked it enough to give it exposure. You can find so many of the actual letters around the internet, and they have some really interesting and odd, weird details and kind of funny stories. Not haha funny, but odd interactions that are very human. Like, I think it was a sergeant who talked to a sniper who he said was the best sniper in the German army at just 18 or 19 years old. And he told the sniper during their interaction, I think they were smoking together, about how he hoped that they would kill him the next day because they knew where he was sniping from now. It's just such a weird thing to say to someone that you're meeting and talking very admirably about and admirably to and being congenial with, but also recognizing that if you don't kill him, there's going to be more of your soldiers dead. War just creates such a weird environment, especially when enemies are smoking with one another. And at one point on the front, they scheduled a soccer match to be played in the future, but the military leaders got word of this and shut it down and planned to send artillery shells into the enemy trenches and camps on that day, so they couldn't have the match. It was a war, after all, so they kind of wanted these people to get back to the business of killing as soon as possible. So I do want to comment on this story in general, but first I'm going to read to you one more letter that's an actual letter and not a fictionalized one from a British captain. And as I read this letter, I think you'll recognize some of the lines are taken verbatim from this letter and used in Aaron Shepherd's fictional letter. It starts, I think I've seen today one of the most extraordinary sights anyone has ever seen. About 10 o'clock this morning, I was peeping over the parapet when I saw a German waving his arms, and presently two of them got out of their trench and came toward ours. We were just going to fire on them when we saw they had no rifles, So one of our men went to meet them, and in about 2 minutes, the ground between the two lines of trenches was swarming with men and officers of both sides, shaking hands and wishing each other a happy Christmas. And that's probably the most disturbing part of the letter, where people are not wishing each other a Merry Christmas, but a Happy Christmas. It's not a birthday, you guys. I guess it is a birthday. But it's not a person that isn't Jesus' birthday. For everyone else's birthday, you say Happy Birthday, but for Jesus' birthday, you say Merry Birthday or Christmas. Those Brits are renowned for being so improper. The captain continues. He says, "From what I gathered, most of them would be glad to get home again, as we should. We have had our pipes playing all day, and everyone has been walking about in the open, unmolested." He adds to that story in another letter. He says, "We had another parley with the Germans in the middle. We exchanged cigarettes and autographs, and some people took photos. I don't know how long it will go on for. I believe it was supposed to stop yesterday, but we can hear no firing going on along the front today, except a little distant shelling. We are, at any rate, having another truce on New Year's Day, as the Germans want to see how the photos come out." Man, the unfictionalized letters are as beautiful as the fictionalized one. Also, is fictionalized a word, or did I just make one up? I'm not sure, but you guys know what I meant. I'm kind of like Shakespeare, I guess, without the storytelling ability. Both of these letter writers are describing what I would call a piece of heaven on earth, where men beat their swords into plowshares, or I guess they beat their trenches into markets and studies and party rooms, where they smoked together and talked and exchanged goods and ideas and were cordial with one another. It sounds like a fairy tale, but it happened in real life on Christmas 1914. To be honest, guys, I don't really care about Christmas. You know that verse in Romans where it talks about how one person thinks some days are really special and another person just thinks basically every day is pretty much the same. I'm the boring guy who esteems every day alike. But stories like this change that. If this is what the Christmas spirit is, where enemies become friends, where miracles of kindness and goodness and gentleness and compassion and love happen, then I guess sign me up for Christmas. Maybe I'll be one of those people who gets excited for spring to come so I can start listening to Christmas music as soon as possible. It seems unlikely. It's just this idea of peace is so attractive. I'll do whatever I can to keep the Christmas spirit alive every day of the year if I thought it would make a difference. This story is a reflection of the heart of Christian anarchy. It's an acting out of many of the same principles. It's about seeing every human as someone who bears the image of God and treating every human as someone who God has given dominion over their own life. It is about not using the government as a justification for or reason for doing violence to one's fellow human being. It is a story of rebelling against rulers by humanizing humans. What could be more Christian anarchist-like than that? The men on all sides were soldiers. Few groups, if any, are taught more regularly and more forcefully to obey the orders of their rulers than soldiers are. Their orders at the time may not have been to actively engage in killing their enemy, as many groups on both sides were waiting for reinforcements. But certainly their orders from the high-ranking officials were not to befriend and fraternize with the enemy. Despite all their training to obey orders, in this obvious violation of the will of their rulers, these soldiers engaged in civil disobedience to befriend the people they were supposed to kill. For this day, these men refrained from violating others because some ruler told them to. They saw their enemy for who they were, either children of God or those God longed to make his children. They allowed this truth about the people on the other side of no man's land to reign in their hearts and in their actions, rather than allow the word of their rulers to reign. By recognizing the God-given value of their opponent and acting in accordance with this recognition, they rebelled against their rulers. It was as if each side said together in a sort of spontaneous Christmas agreement, "They want us to hate, but we will not. They want us to fight each other, but we will not. They want us not to trade with each other, but we will not listen. They wish us not to play games, but we will play and laugh and enjoy one another. They wish us not to exchange ideas, but we will talk and share our thoughts. They wish us not to sing songs of worship together about the God in human flesh we both love, but we will sing all the louder. They wish us to demonize our enemy, but we will not. Not today. Not on Christmas." The very high-ranking officers, the ones who didn't spend much time in the trenches, did not appreciate this impromptu outbreak of peace at various points across the front lines. They had a job to do, given to them from their rulers. They had a war to win, and it's tough to win a war when the soldiers are singing Christmas carols with the enemy. The generals quickly stamped out future truces. They threatened martial law. Some soldiers and groups of soldiers had to be sent to other locations because they wouldn't fight the people they just befriended. The saddest part about the story of the Christmas truce is that the day didn't last. But for a moment, men let their light shine in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it, and their lights, when gathered together, burned so bright. This moment is remembered a century later, and I suspect will be remembered for a millennia. While this story is a great reflection of Christian anarchy because it is disobeying the will of the rulers and instead motivated by the love of Christ, the ruled insist on treating their fellow man with dignity, it is really more simply a great Christmas story that highlights some of the themes of God coming to earth as a baby. The point of Jesus coming to earth as a child was not so centuries later Christians could set aside December 25th as a day to open presents under a tree and feel happy and joyful and warm-hearted that day. It was about peace on earth and goodwill toward men. And it wasn't just meant for that day. Jesus came to bring peace on earth and peace with God and peace with our brothers and sisters every day. It's nice that this happened one day, but that is such a small dream compared to what God imagines and envisions and is working to bring in the world, which is that sort of peace on earth, universalized throughout the earth every day. It's about a world where there is peace and wholeness, and love, and war has ceased. It is about this kind of Christmas spirit we saw in World War I being present in all places at all times. When Jesus first came to earth, the people he came to didn't get it. They didn't understand him at first, and they didn't understand him for a long time. And even then, they only partially understood him, and many still don't understand him. This is because he was not the type of Messiah they were expecting. And the people, in order to accept Jesus, had to go against their religious rulers. It was the political and religious rulers of the location that were the primary forces in seeking to demean Jesus and undermine Jesus, and eventually, because they were unable to discount him and defame him, they killed Jesus. So for anyone at the time who would follow Jesus, they had to go against the will of their political and religious rulers. And they had to trust in Jesus. They had to trust in what they saw and trust in what they were experiencing and feeling and sensing, and trust in a power that was higher than their political and religious rulers ever could be. It was the same with these soldiers during their Christmas truce. For a day, they didn't trust their rulers. They didn't obey them. They didn't believe the things they told them about the people on the other side of the trenches. They saw their enemy in light of the story of Jesus, in light of his humble and universal love. They had to reject the so-called truth told to them by their superiors, at least for this day. They prioritized instead the truth of the coming of Christ above the words of their military masters. They knew there was someone, something greater, the creator of a higher law than the law of their government. The story of Christmas is the story of the higher power these troops chose to trust instead of their rulers. The story is not just of a sinless baby being born or God becoming man, but also the story of the birth of Jesus is the story of the true king of the people of God coming back to reign over Israel. It is the story of God fixing what went wrong when Israel chose to have a human king reign over them by being the human king to reign over them. God cleverly, simultaneously fixed the problem of their sinful desire for a human king and accommodated that same sinful desire. It's such a beautiful story of God meeting people in their sin, fixing the problem of that sin, and being their true king to lead them into redemption, peace, and new life. King Jesus has come to earth, and he is in the process of setting up his kingdom in the midst of anyone who wants to follow him. The story of the soldiers gathering together in no man's land is one where they treated Jesus like king. There is a law higher than government legislation, and a lawgiver above all rulers. All men are under him, and no man was ever made to be over one another. The story of Christmas is where the sole rightful ruler of humanity, the God who wanted to be the good king, who reigned over humanity all along, has come to earth to take his place on the throne. If he is king, there can be no other. Somehow, some way, for some reason, by the grace of God, on that Christmas in 1914, soldiers from both sides of the war integrated the truth of Jesus' kingship into their action, and for a magical moment in time, they discovered they were not enemies who belonged to separate kingdoms of England and Germany, but citizens of the same kingdom of heaven. The truth is, they were brothers. I guess that's it. I'm not sure how one wraps that up, hopefully tightly and with transparent scotch tape with a nice little bow. But I'm not sure how to do that verbally. I could say something like water lily. That kind of puts an image of your head that's pretty like a verbal wrapping paper, right? All right, I'm going to be out of here. I won't be putting out an episode next week unless I'm feeling really generous or I really want to talk. It is Christmas after all, and I could use a week off. Plus, Christmas is a time of peace anyway. As long as a bunch of people are going to church and talking about peace on earth and goodwill toward man, I feel like I can take a week off. Other people are doing the same thing I try to do every week anyway. So I'll talk to you next year. Get it? Because it'll be 2016. Oh yeah, that's a classic. Next year you'll notice some changes as, after all the arguments against Christian anarchy I've heard from people, I've dramatically changed my views. So this podcast will be about atheistic statism. Now, is that statement true? It could be, but you'll have to tune in January to find out. Oh, what a cliffhanger. Happy Christmas to all, and be sure to treat others like it's Christmas all year round. Peace and love, and to all a good night. Ho, ho, ho.